tuned in to the Community Cats Podcast. Ready? Let's go.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our webinar. I am thrilled to be here with you this afternoon. This is Better Together, TNVR and Public Health with Dr. Bob Whedon. My name is Brianna Lovell-Myers, and I am the Executive Director of United Spay Alliance. United Spay Alliance is a national nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting affordable, accessible, and timely spay-neuter services. We are all things spay-neuter, and we often say that spay-neuter is public health for pets. And so it fits right in with the topic of today's webinar for sure. Dr. Whedon is a community cat and high-quality, high-volume spay-neuter surgeon at Paws Plus Veterinary in Lakeland, Florida. He's the former medical director and high-quality, high-volume spay-neuter surgeon with the Animal Rescue Coalition in Sarasota, Florida, and previously served as a clinical assistant professor at the University of Illinois, where he trained veterinary students in high-quality, high-volume spay-neuter techniques. Dr. Whedon also instructs veterinarians through his consulting company, SNIP, or Spay Neuter Instructional Program. A dedicated advocate for pet overpopulation solutions, Dr. Whedon is a member of the Veterinary Shortage Task Force here at United Spay Alliance. He is also involved with other organizations like Alley Cat Allies and serves on the board of directors for the Alliance for Contraception and Cats and Dogs, or ACC&D. Dr. Whedon holds degrees from Purdue University and the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Dr. Whedon, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Bree, and thanks to United Spay Alliance and Community Cats Podcast for hosting this. Yeah, we're going to start out with a poll question. So we'd like to get an idea of the audience here and whether or not you're actively involved in community cat management, whether you're a veterinarian or a vet tech performing surgery, an animal control officer, a trapper, colony caregiver, or just unaffiliated with TNVR. That's interesting. 68% trapper or colony caretaker, 20% veterinarian or veterinary technician, one animal control officer. Thank you for being here. Sometimes TNVR programs are in conflict with animal control, and it's nice to have animal control people here learning more about TNVR. Okay, and just four people, I guess, who just didn't have anything better to do. I'm sure there are probably some of my friends that I shamed into attending today. So you're probably familiar with the term TNR, and even Bree, in her introductory comments, you know, she referred to TNVR, and I have been advocating for this term for several years now. Why? The V stands for vaccinate, which emphasizes the public health aspect of TNVR programs, including vaccinating for rabies as a means of protecting the health of the public. Incorporating the public health component of TNVR programs engages a whole new group of stakeholders, the public health community, in addition to the animal welfare community, in support of humane sterilization of community cats. And this is important for individuals who are trying to get their municipalities or their communities to support TNVR. It's not just about the well-being of the cats, but also how these programs can indeed protect the health of the public. So we're all aware of the growing body of evidence indicating that TNVR is not only effective at reducing community cat numbers, but that such reductions are sustainable over extended periods. Here's a figure from a paper done by my friend and colleague, Peter Wolf, showing an 85% decline in the number of cats on the University of Central Florida campus as a result of a long-term TNVR program. In a study published in the Veterinary Journal in 2014, Levy et al. Reported that high-impact TNVR combined with the adoption of socialized cats and nuisance resolution counseling for residents is an effective tool for reducing shelter cat intake. annual per capita community cat trap neuter vaccinate return surgeries in the target area A increased significantly during the two study years 1 and 2. This was accompanied by a significant decrease in shelter cat intake and euthanasia. In the non-target area B, annual TNVR surgeries remained at a baseline rate, and shelter cat intake and euthanasia did not change significantly. Per capita results are reported as cats per 1,000 residents, and the asterisk is interpreted as significantly different than the mean plus or minus 2 standard deviations of 5 pretreatment years. Now, this is a topic for a whole nother webinar, but the point of this is that with sufficient application intensity, TNVR can indeed reduce both shelter intake, shelter euthanasia. Historically, animal welfare and public health have often been in conflict, with life-saving efforts seen as compromising public health. However, there's a major shift taking place now. Today, many communities have adopted progressive policies and practices that effectively address both public health and animal welfare concerns. For example, it hasn't been so long ago that the National Animal Control Association changed their name to National Animal Care and Control Association. And recently, shelter medicine is the second most popular area of interest for students entering vet schools nationally. So a Venn diagram uses overlapping circles to illustrate the similarities and differences and relationships between concepts, ideas, categories, or groups. Similarities between groups are represented in the overlapping portions of the circles, while differences are represented in the non-overlapping portions of the circles. Here is one of my favorite explanations of a Venn diagram based on the U2 song, With or Without You, where the lyrics say, with or without you, I can't live with or without you. I prefer to look at the relationship between animal welfare and public health in the context of a Venn diagram. There are some overlaps between the two disciplines, notably rabies prevention and what we're going to talk about today, TNVR, and how it can benefit both sides of our Venn diagram. I like to think of TNVR as a slide rule. Who amongst us knows what a slide rule is? I used one in high school. I guess that tells you how old I am. It worked well, but was a little cumbersome to carry around and to use. My freshman year of undergrad, my first year of college, the first pocket calculator came out. While the slide rule still worked, the pocket calculator was more convenient and faster. Imagine being the slide rule manufacturer the day the pocket calculator came out. TNVR is like a slide rule. Something better will come along, but until that time, it's better than doing nothing. Yeah, TNVR is the best public policy for community cats. It reduces shelter intake and euthanasia, reduces complaint calls to municipalities, saves taxpayer money. It's supported by more than 70% of the American public. And as we're going to learn today, it protects the health of domestic animals and people. Probably the most notable attack on TNVR is the 2016 book, Cat Wars, The Devastating Consequences of a Cuddly Killer. According to Mara, who since 2019 is the dean of Georgetown University's Earth Commons Institute for the Environment and Sustainability and a professor of biology and environment, who had previously been with the Smithsonian Institution's Conservation Biology Institute since 1999 and ran its Migratory Bird Center, outdoor cats are, quote, unrelenting killers and cauldrons of disease, whose quote-unquote devastating consequences must be dealt with by eradication in the name of biodiversity. Quote, from a conservation ecology perspective, the most desirable solution seems to be clear. remove all free ranging cats from the landscape by any means necessary, unquote. Since when did killing one species in the name of another ever make any sense? Recently, opponents of TNVR programs have focused on two public health issues, rabies and toxoplasmosis, in their efforts to scare people regarding the apparent threats to these diseases posed by feral and free-roaming cats. We're going to discuss these two diseases today and demonstrate why TNVR programs actually protect people in their communities from these threats. Every year, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention publishes rabies surveillance in the United States during the previous year. This comprehensive document lists the numbers and percentages of wild and domestic animals diagnosed with rabies. It also gives guidance for what is considered exposure. The figures shown represent annual surveillance data from 2022, the latest year for which it's available. So in 2022, there were 17,406 cats tested for rabies, of which 222, or 1.3%, were confirmed rabid. So this is really in line with the mean percentage during the previous 5 years, which was 1.3%, with a 95% confidence interval of 1.1 to 1.5%. It varies year to year, up and down a little bit, but it stays pretty constant at this level. During 2018, antemortem samples from 23 human patients in 17 states and U.S. territories suspected of having rabies were submitted to the CDC for laboratory diagnostic testing, of which 13% were confirmed to be positive. Nowhere does it list the cat as a source of exposure for a person acquiring rabies during 2018. And that's the last year that for which reporting exists. So that brings us to our next poll question. When was the last documented case of human rabies attributed to exposure from a cat? And your choices are 2024, 2005, 1995, or 1975. Let's see what you think here. Pretty good. 49% said 1975, 41% said 1995. As a matter of fact, the last documented case of human rabies from exposure to a rabid cat was in 1975. This according to two different documents, one published in the American Journal of the American Veterinary Medical Association, another Journal of Neuropathology and Experimental Neurology. 1975, it's been a long time since a human has acquired rabies from a cat, but the threat is still there. The latest CDC document shows the distribution of major rabies virus variants in the U.S. and Puerto Rico during the period 2014 to 2018. What stands out to me is the Eastern raccoon rabies virus variant. Most of the rabid cats were imported from states where the raccoon rabies virus variant was considered enzootic. As a matter of fact, it's interesting to note that over 50% of the rabid cats were reported from states where the raccoon rabies virus variant was considered enzootic. Pennsylvania led the list with 47, followed by Virginia, New Jersey, and Georgia. These are all states where the Eastern raccoon rabies virus variant is enzootic. So I want to reiterate, emphasizing the public health aspect of TNVR programs. We're vaccinating against rabies as a means of protecting the health of the public. And one of my take-home messages from this presentation is vaccinating community cats creates a barrier to the disease between wildlife and domestic animals and people. An important concept to understand is herd immunity. You probably remember hearing about it during the COVID pandemic. Herd immunity is a form of indirect protection from infectious disease that occurs when a large percentage of a population has become immune to an infection, thereby providing a measure of protection for individuals who are not immune. Individuals who are immune to a disease act as a barrier in the spread of the disease, slowing or preventing the transmission of disease to others. These diagrams illustrate the concept of herd immunity and illustrate how rabies could spread in a susceptible colony of feral cats if each infected animal were exposed to two other cats. The blue dot represents an unvaccinated infected animal. The white dot represents a susceptible but uninfected animal. And the orange dot represents an immune cat who will not pass the infection to others. In the absence of herd immunity on the left side of the diagram, you see that the number of cases doubles each disease generation. We see that in the presence of 50% herd immunity, the number of cases, blue dots, remains constant. That's how herd immunity works. So one of the problems that we encounter is that animal control agencies will continue to trap community cats even after they've been spayed or neutered and vaccinated. What happens if two vaccinated cats are trapped and removed and subsequently replaced with susceptible cats? Trap and removal of previously vaccinated cats will actually increase the susceptible population of cats. Times two. If two vaccinated cats are trapped and removed and replaced with susceptible cats, then the number of rabid cats in the colony skyrockets. There's published evidence in support of this. Fisher et al. Published an article in JAMA entitled Response of Feral Cats to Vaccination at the Time of Neutering. This article showed that prior to vaccination, some cats had protective serum antibody titers, but only 3% of them had antibodies to rabies virus. Notably, following vaccination for rabies, 98% of the cats had protective serum antiviral antibodies titers. Their conclusions were that feral cats appeared to have an excellent immune response following vaccination at the time of neutering. Some veterinarians don't like to vaccinate at the time of surgery because they fear that the immune response will be lessened due to stress. This study shows that not to be the case. They further concluded that incorporation of vaccination into trap-neuter return programs is likely to protect the health of individual cats and possibly reduce the disease burden in the community, hence TNVR. They also concluded that vaccination of feral cats at the time of neutering may protect them for much of their remaining life, because immunity that develops following vaccination has been shown to persist for a minimum of 3 to 7 years in most cats. Now, one caveat. Cats should be retrapped if possible and boosted for rabies according to guidelines established by the American Association of Feline Practitioners. Also, many states have laws regarding rabies vaccination, and as veterinarians, we cannot arbitrarily ignore or alter those. This is why we are advocating that all TNVR programs include the V. Not only are we preventing cats from reproducing, but we're building a barrier to a disease that will protect domestic animals and people.
Kittens may be small, but caring for them takes big knowledge. And the Online Kitten Conference is here to help. Join us on June 7th and 8th for 2 full days of expert-led sessions focused entirely on kitten care, fostering, and program management. From bottle feeding to behavior, this conference covers it all. It's a fully virtual event, so you can tune in from anywhere. And registration includes access to the recordings, slides, and handouts. You'll hear from experienced professionals, get access to valuable resources, and connect with a community that shares your passion for saving lives. Learn more and register at communitycatspodcast.com/kittens, because the tiniest lives deserve the best care. In a recent study, 97% of respondents said that pets are family. Communities can play a vital role in helping to keep families together, whether it's reuniting lost pets with their owners, donating pet supplies or funds for pet owners in need, or offering short or long-term fostering. People can help keep pets and their people together. We just have to show them how. Did you know there are resources you can use to help bring attention to the programs you offer to help them do just that? From public service announcements, short videos, printable posters, online and social graphics, and much more. Find your resources at
www.petsandpeopletogether.org/campaign-resources. Hashtag be a helper. Tomahawk Live Trap exceeds customers' expectations by providing them with the highest quality humane animal control products available. Check out their new Pro Series Gravity Door Trap. They feature a door that sets automatically when you open it. No hook or plate setting needed. Use discount code KEEPITHUMANE for 10% off your order at livetrap.com.
Another disease that Mara brings up is toxoplasmosis. Mara says in Cat Wars, quote, "It is becoming increasingly clear that toxoplasmosis is a significant zoonotic disease, perhaps one of the most significant, that impacts humans globally. And it emerges primarily from outdoor domestic cats," unquote. Yeah, well, maybe not so much. You know, we're going to look a little more closely at the organism and its life cycle. And hint, I'm going to show you how TNVR programs can prevent the spread of toxoplasmosis. But first, another poll question. So Mara would have you believe that these cats are shedding organisms all over willy-nilly. So the question I have is, how long do these cats shed the T. gondii organism? Your choices are for life, 3 weeks, 3 months, or 3 years. And if you don't know, take a guess. I'm impressed. You guys seem to know a fair bit about toxoplasmosis. The life cycle of toxoplasmosis is very complex. But the cat is the definitive host of the organism, and the organism is shed in their feces for only a short period of time, 1 to 3 weeks, once in a cat's lifetime. I'm going to say that again. The organism is shed in their feces for a short period of time, 1 to 3 weeks, once in a cat's lifetime. Most cats are infected at a young age when they start to hunt and consume an infected rodent. Mara would have you believe that cats are out there shedding toxoplasmosis organisms constantly, and as a result, pose a threat to people and pets, which is why he's been quoted as saying that we need to, quote, remove all free-ranging cats from the landscape by any means necessary, unquote. That isn't going to work, folks. Nor will it solve the problem of toxoplasmosis, nor is it humane. First of all, there's no, in capital letters, way that we will ever remove all free-ranging cats. Consider this. Preventing kittens from being born will decrease the amount of T. gondii organisms in the environment. This is why TNVR programs are so effective at preventing toxoplasmosis. By sterilizing community cats, these young cats are never born and therefore are unable to shed the T. gondii organism. This is from the textbook Infectious Disease of the Dog and Cat by Craig Green. And it has been said by many obstetricians over time that, oh, you're pregnant, get rid of your cat because you don't want to acquire this disease from the cat. And that's so wrong. It's so, you know, it's really important to understand that these cats, they become infected from carnivorous behavior soon after weaning and shed oocysts for only short periods, under 3 weeks thereafter, once in their lifetime. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Dr. Green's textbook, ingestion of undercooked meat or contamination of uncooked foods by cutting boards used to prepare raw meat is a common source of toxoplasma infection. As a matter of fact, in the textbook Handbook of Zoonoses Identification and Prevention, Colville and Berryhill say, quote, "Cats have gotten a bad rap about how they transmit toxoplasmosis to humans and how they cause spontaneous abortion in women and blindness and mental retardation in newborn and older children. While it is true that cats are the only definitive host for the infectious stage of the toxoplasma organism, they are not the most common source of human infection. The most efficient way to get toxoplasmosis from a cat is to eat the cat undercooked. That's from a veterinary textbook. And again, there's substantial scientific evidence that when properly applied, TMVR has been shown to help control slash reduce the population of free roaming cats. And some take home messages from today, folks. Feral cats appear to have excellent immune response following vaccination at the time of neutering. Incorporation of vaccination into trap neuter return programs is likely to protect the health of individual cats and possibly reduce disease burden in the community. And TNVR programs prevent the birth of kittens who, as they grow, start to prey on rodents where they acquire the T. gondii organism. If those kittens are never born, they will never be able to shed the organism. TNVR not only reduces reproduction, but it also protects the health of the public. Okay, our final poll question. I'm curious as to how many of you vaccinate kittens that are less than 12 weeks of age. That's the vaccine label minimum for rabies. And the choices are all the time, some of the time, know if they can be diverted to foster slash adopt or never. And the reason I'm asking this question is that a lot of progressive TNVR programs will divert these young kittens to foster for socialization and subsequent adoption, which is a great thing if they have the resources. If they don't have those resources, these kittens get vaccinated and then returned back to the colony. Now, critics of TNVR programs will say, but that's under the label minimum age. You don't know that it works. And they're right. We didn't have data. There's never been a peer-reviewed scientific study to demonstrate efficacy until now. We recently completed a pilot study where 10 kittens less than 12 weeks of age, as determined by their weight, less than 3 pounds, and their teeth, no eruption of incisor teeth, were vaccinated for rabies. We drew blood for rabies titers pre-vaccination, and none of them had detectable antibody levels. All 10 kittens were sterilized and vaccinated for rabies. We repeated the titers 28 days after vaccination. All of them had titers significantly above the 0.5 international unit per milliliter level considered protective. The average was 8.8 international units per milliliter, and the range was 1.9 to greater than 13 international units per milliliter. We intend to publish these results in a peer-reviewed journal, so stay tuned. Our conclusion is that vaccinating these kittens is indeed effective, given the fact that this may be the only rabies vaccine that kitten never receives. The practice should be encouraged. And one other thing I want to mention before we open it up for questions. Bree, when she was introducing me, mentioned that I'm on the board of directors of the Alliance for Contraception in Cats and Dogs. Now, I don't know how many of you are aware of what ACC&D is, but I would encourage you, if you're interested, to go to the ACC&D website. It's c-d.org, and to learn a little bit. The ACC&D is an organization that is dedicated to helping develop and promote the use of non-surgical forms of contraception. Our mission is to advance non-surgical sterilants and contraceptives for cats and dogs and to promote their global accessibility. Imagine what we could do if we only had to give these community cats an injection to sterilize them. You know, right now, a large-scale TNVR clinic might sterilize 100 cats in a day, having several surgeons, you know, doing surgery. Imagine how many cats we could sterilize if we only had to give them an injection. So these are some really cutting edge things, folks. The vaccination data now showing that rabies vaccine in kittens under 12 weeks of age is indeed effective. And also these developing of a non-surgical sterilant to humanely and safely sterilize community cats, I think you're going to see some really great things coming down the pike. So with that, let's open it up for questions.
So I'm going to backtrack a little bit. What criteria does the CDC use to test cats for rabies? Do you know how that process works, like where the data comes from?
Yeah, the testing methodology they use is pretty standard. It's the gold standard for diagnosing rabies. The immunohistochemistry section on part of the brain. And the criteria whether or not to test, if I'm understanding the question correctly, that's determined by the submitting organization, like an animal control authority. But typically, they will test an animal that has bitten a human and cannot be quarantined for a 10-day period. And the 10-day quarantine comes from the fact that it's a known biological fact that if the animal's shedding virus in its saliva at the time of the bite, it will show clinical signs of rabies within 10 days, usually much sooner than that. So if the animal then at the end of a 10-day quarantine is not showing signs of rabies, then we're very confident in saying that it was not shedding virus in the saliva at the time of the bite. Now, some animals can't be quarantined. Maybe a feral cat that just, it would be inhumane to quarantine that animal for 10 days in a cage because they're not used to that. Or the animal, say it was hit by a car and a Good Samaritan was trying to help and it bit the Good Samaritan, but then subsequently died. Then those animals should be tested for rabies by the CDC or a local lab. But it is very expensive to test for rabies. So oftentimes, you know, it's less expensive to quarantine an animal for that 10-day period. And that's not to be confused with an exposure quarantine, which is totally different. If an animal is exposed to a rabid or potentially rabid animal, then, and it's never been vaccinated, the recommendation now is to go ahead and vaccinate the animal and then quarantine it for 4 months to ensure it doesn't develop rabies. So I hope that answered the question.
No, I think that's a helpful timeline and kind of explanation of how the process works.
Right.
So when we are administering a rabies vaccination to cats through the TNVR programs, how long does immunity from a single rabies vaccination last?
Well, and that's a really good question because the rabies vaccines, there are 1 year and 3 year rabies vaccines on the market. And the way they are determined to be 1 or 3 year is because the animals, the companies, when they're developing them, actually vaccinate the test animals. And then they are challenged with virulent rabies vaccine, either 1 year or 3 years post-vaccination. And so even the three-year vaccine, the label says that it should be boosted in a year. And then subsequent vaccines are good for 3 years. But Fisher et al., and there are some other people who have been working on this, notably Ron Schultz at Wisconsin and recently retired, they have shown that immunity lasts longer than the label time. And last I read, there was protective immunity out to like 7 years from a 3 year rabies vaccine. But again, we can't change the label. Label says that to vaccinate, booster in a year, and then every 3 years after that. But we know that immunity does indeed last longer. And that's my argument for vaccinating these young kittens that, you know, that may be the only rabies shot they ever get. And that immunity will likely protect them for longer. Ideally, they should be boosted in a year. If a TNVR program has the resources and can retrap these animals and booster them, but many organizations don't have those resources and that's impractical.
All right. So I do have a question about the new study that you mentioned in kittens. Were follow-up titer tests done after the initial 28-day test? Were there any changes in antibodies after that initial post-vaccination titer test? Is it safe to assume protection after 28 days will last long-term, like the 3 to 7 years in adults?
Yeah, that's a good question. We chose 28 days because the Compendium of Animal Rabies Prevention and Control says that an animal is not considered currently vaccinated until 28 days post-vaccine, because that's when the peak antibody titer should be detectable. So that's why we chose 28 days. And no, the titers will slowly drop over time. This was just a pilot study with just 10 kittens. Now we're putting together a larger study, actually a case control study, where we'll have control cats that are not vaccinated, that ideally will have no detectable titer prior to vaccine, no detectable titer after not being vaccinated, compared with a group that are vaccinated. And I think we will try to follow those longer. I think we may, ideally, it would be good to titer them at 28 days to show a response, and then maybe like even a year later or 6 months later to show a sustained response. But again, this was just a pilot study. All we were looking for is, did these kittens respond to the rabies vaccine being under the label age? And guess what? We showed that. They did respond.
Which is a terrific, I think, data-backed proof, I think, in our back pocket. Yeah,
because I've been challenged. Actually, I was in a presentation like this. It wasn't online. It was a live presentation. And somebody in the audience, when we were talking about this very fact, said, raise their hand. I called on them and said, well, how do you know it works? And I was kind of like, because we do it. You know, there's no data that shows that it was effective. And, you know, I think the thinking was, when they chose the 12-week minimum age, is that if the kitten had maternal antibodies, that might actually block the effectiveness of the vaccines. But in this situation, it's highly unlikely that kittens are going to have much, if any, maternal antibodies. I think that was the 3% in Fisher's study. The 3% that had antibodies prior to vaccination were probably maternal antibodies, and that the kittens got from the mother through the colostrum when they first nursed. So, yeah, I mean, there was no data that showed that these kittens under 12 weeks of age were successfully vaccinated. Well, now we have it.
That's awesome. All right. One last little question, not directly related to rabies, but how long do the FVRCP vaccines last, and do they need to be an annual shot?
You know, I'm not a virologist, but I will tell you that I have a 14-year-old cat that I have not given an FVRCP vaccine to since he was like 2 years of age, because he's an indoor-only cat. And immunity, again, if you read that paper from the Fisher et al. Paper that I cited, they showed immunity persists. I think the longest they went out was 7 years. But I have read other things and had conversations with other clinicians that's very, if they had a series of the kitten or a one year, 2 year, maybe boosters, they are quite likely immune for life.
Good news. I want to thank you, Dr. Whedon, for sharing your expertise with us today. I want to thank everyone who was able to tune in this afternoon. I want to give a shout out to Kristen, our technical tabby in the background, and Community Cats Podcast for their never-ending support of the work that we're doing. So thank you one and all. I hope you have an excellent day, that you go out and continue to care for those colonies, have successful TNVR programs, and we're here as a resource if you need us. So thanks so much, and we'll catch you next time. Thank you, Dr. Whedon.
Thank you for TNVR. Good for you.
That's it for this week. Please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a review. We love to hear what you think, and a 5-star review really helps others find the show. You can also join the conversation with listeners, cat caretakers, and me on Facebook and Instagram. And don't forget to hit follow or subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, YouTube, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a single show. Thanks for listening, and thank you for everything that you do to help create a safe and healthy world for cats.